Okay, let's go ahead and call the committee to order. I see we do not have a quorum, so why don't we start with testimony. Today we have a presentation from the Minnesota Finance Campaign Board. Gary Goldsmith is the executive director. Please state your name for the tape there and proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And on behalf of myself and the board, I wish to thank the chair and the committee for this opportunity to meet this morning with you and have a conversation about the board and what it does and about campaign finance law in general. I don't have any handouts or PowerPoint this morning. I really just want to have a conversation to give you some highlights. I know that all of you have had some experience with the board, at least with respect to registering a campaign committee and filing reports with the board in order to get elected, or you wouldn't be here today. I'm going to start just by introducing the board and its operations, then give you some very high-level facts and figures that help explain what we do and the scope of our work. I want to talk a little bit about why we even would have a campaign finance board. What's the rationale for having an organization that regulates campaign finance and the disclosure about those matters? Finally, talk about some of the innovations we've done over the last few years and what we plan for the future. And then I want to conclude with some brief comments about public subsidy programs, why they exist or why some people think they exist, and how much they cost, because that's going to be a topic throughout this legislative session, I think. And while I won't be advocating for a position on it, I want to give you some information that we can share with you. I've already introduced myself. I'm essentially what would be the chief executive officer of the board. I'd also like to make one additional introduction to another person who many of you may have talked to already and may in the future if you haven't, and that's Assistant Director Jeff Sigurdsson. Jeff? Jeff is the number two officer of the board, and when I'm not available for calls, he always is. So one of the other you can reach. We also have qualified staff members who are happy to help you. We'd like you to call anytime you want, and a call will never trigger some kind of a board action. We're here to provide information. The Campaign Finance Board was established in 1974, and this was in the era of Watergate. It was a time when money in politics was completely unlimited and unregulated. There was actually corruption and quid pro quo activities between donors and candidates, at least at the federal level. The federal government stepped in and enacted broad sweeping campaign finance regulations, and Minnesota followed shortly thereafter, modeling its law after the federal law. At that time, the Campaign Finance Board was actually called the Minnesota State Ethics Commission. Later, its name was changed to the Minnesota Ethical Practices Board, and then in the 90s to the Campaign Finance Board. And this progression is kind of natural because in the early days, money and politics was really considered a question of ethics. That changed over the years, and now it's really just a regulatory and disclosure program. And the legislature recognized that violations of Chapter 10A that we administer weren't really ethical violations or ethics violations as the people believe them to be now, and so they changed the name to more appropriately reflect what we do. The board actually consists of six members. All of them are appointed by the governor. All of those appointments are confirmed by both bodies of the legislature. It's the only agency or board that has that criteria. So we will have at least one member and as many as three members coming before this committee yet this year, where you will hear about their qualifications and make a recommendation to the full body as to whether they should be confirmed or not. The board members serve staggered terms of 4 years, and because Governor Pawlenty has been in office or was in office for 8 years, that means all of the current board members were appointed by Governor Pawlenty. But by statutory definition, the board is multi-partisan, so it has members from both parties and some independent members. And we have found that when members begin their service on the board, they are able to set aside their partisan ideas and work for the promotion of the statute. We're given the statute by the legislature, and it's our job to carry out the purposes and provisions of that statute to the best of our ability. without regard to the party of the member of the board or the party of the person who appears before us. We have a staff of eight. For quite a few years we had a staff of nine, but we have been in a continuous planning mode for change, and that change typically, in our view, involves no more money. So in some cases it has to involve less or fewer staff, and we downsize from nine to eight. We have a plan for the next 4 years where that would decrease additionally as salaries go up and don't support our staff complement. I want to give you an idea of what those eight staff members handle on an annual basis. You already know we have campaign finance in our portfolio. We have right now 828 campaign committees registered, actually a few more because we got about six registered yesterday as a result of the special election. We have 332 party units, 371 political committees and funds, often referred to as PACs, although that word doesn't appear in Minnesota statutes. And then last year, the legislature created a new kind of entity, an independent expenditure committee or fund that can use corporate money but can only make independent expenditures, and we have 24 of that new type of entity. So we regulate over 1,500 different entities in the campaign finance program. In the lobbyist program, we have 1,337 regulated lobbyists, and we have more than 2,100 public officials filing financial disclosure with us. So on a regular basis, each year we deal with more than 5,000 individual entities who are actually regulated in some way by us, and thousands more interested persons, including members of the public. A lot of money flows through the programs that are administered by the Campaign Finance Board. I want to concentrate only on campaign finance money because the campaign finance program is the most complex and the one that takes up the most of our time. Contributions received by candidates such as yourselves, and we're looking at figures now through the pre-general election report. So you remember you all filed a report before the general election. That covered up to 2 weeks before the general election. Just based on those numbers, candidates had raised $19 million, and other organizations had raised almost $50 million. So we saw $68 million come into the campaign finance system during that period. During that same period, candidates spent $23 million. Other organizations spent $20 million. So we saw more than $44 million of spending, not counting independent expenditures, which added another $12 million, so about $57 million in spending. That money, if you think about it, is all money that is, in a sense, public money, because either it comes from a public subsidy program, which the legislature provides, or it comes from individual donors who give money to candidates and other political organizations. And the Campaign Finance Board is the only organization in a formal way that watches over that money to see that it's raised within the legal parameters and see that it's spent within the legal parameters. So we really consider ourselves to be the public's eye on the money that they donate or that is given to candidates through the tax public subsidy program. I said I would talk about why this board exists or why any campaign finance board might exist, and every state has something like this. I don't think there's a single state that doesn't regulate campaign finance to some extent. The board has a mission statement, and the first sentence, I think, is really the most telling of the board's mission, and it's to promote public confidence in state government decision-making through the development, administration, and enforcement of disclosure programs. The whole idea behind campaign finance regulation and disclosure right from the 70s up to the present day is that if the people can see where the flow of money is, they will be assured that there is no improper flow of money, and they will have confidence in the people that they elect to run the government for them. I think in Minnesota that's been very effective. We have very good disclosure. The problems that we have are typically inadvertent from a lack of understanding or a lack of following instructions that the board provides. But that goal of public knowledge of funding, sunlight in other words, on campaign finance money, has made Minnesota a state that is actually a model for many other states. I think to some extent one might speculate at least that that even has something to do with our high voter turnout, because people are not frustrated with government. They can see into government, and they can see into the people that they're voting for, at least financially.
Excuse me, Mr. Goldstein. Representative Scalzi has a question.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And Mr. Goldstein, I just have a question. We're going to be looking at House File 4 after your presentation, and I'm wondering, when you look at that, and I'm sure that you have looked at it or heard about it, and we're looking at a 15% reduction in the state workforce by 2015, how do you think that would affect the sunlight on the flow of money and promoting public confidence? How do you think that your department can withstand that? Do you have an idea on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, yes, we did take a reduction of about 11% going from 9 to 8. Going from 8 to 7 will be a 12.5% reduction. I would be cautiously optimistic to say that we could do that. And the only reason I say that is because last year the legislature passed one of the board's very important recommendations, and that was to make campaign finance filings by electronic means mandatory. If that statute is implemented the way we believe it will be, and we don't have to grant too many waivers, that will relieve some of the burden that is involved in data entry. It will relieve some of the burden that is involved in doing manual compliance as opposed to electronic compliance. 15% would actually get us down below 7. That would be a big challenge. I think this is always going to be a problem with small agencies. Small agencies don't have any fluff built into their budgets or into their staff complements. When we went from 9 to 8, some of that salary savings was used to hire data entry to make up for the staff person we didn't have. With electronic filing, we'll be able to phase that out. But it will be difficult. Of course, if we have to do it, we will do it. It might result in cutting some of the things that we do. I'd like to talk, and this really leads into sort of my next topic, which is how do we operate and how do we innovate. I personally come from a background in first legal private practice, and then still have my own small business, so I also know how to run that, and it's very tough right now. But I've tried to run the board to the extent that the executive director runs the board. I've tried to operate the board much like a corporation would. The board serves as the board of directors of the corporation. They meet monthly. They make decisions based on complaints that are filed. They make decisions based on things that the staff brings to the board. They delegate as appropriate to the executive director, who delegates to staff. And then the executive director and the staff run the board on a day-to-day basis. And it's part of my responsibility to make sure that we can operate within our means and that we have plans going forward to be able to continue to do that, even though we anticipate less funding as we do go forward. For example, we take part in the various programs that the state has made available to small agencies and to all agencies in particular. One initiative that we're doing right now, which will result in some June or May and June spending, which we typically have to defer things like this to the end of the fiscal year. It's not because we have a lot of money left over, but we don't know if we can do a project until we get toward the end of the fiscal year. And that is to convert our phone system from the old Quest type system that some state agencies are still on to the new voice over IP system that is the new standard for the state. Now, while that's going to cost us some money this year, it's going to save us money every year going forward, to the extent that we expect the payback to be between 3 and 4 years, and we will actually then have a net savings on our investment, and the investment being capital equipment will go forward. We are also hoping to do some reconfiguration of office space. We have a fair amount of space that isn't really used for practical purposes now. We used to have lots and lots of people coming in. We don't have that now. And I'm hoping to configure a workspace so that we could either have interns or volunteers who could come in. We're embarking on an electronics records program that will involve a lot of scanning, and it would be good if we could get people to come in and do that without adding staff. If we have to do it with staff, it'll take years and years. So we hope to use our space to get some essentially free help. I mentioned the online filing system. That's going to be mandatory in 2012. That's just one example of technology, and we really have to leverage technology. All of our lobbyist reporting went online a couple of years ago, and we have had in the high 90% of lobbyists reporting electronically, and that's relieved some staff pressure in that area. I'd like to mention two state programs that I think are valuable and helpful and are examples of innovation in other areas of the state that could be copied. But before I do that, I want to say that we have found that farming things out or doing things outside of the agency itself are not always going to be cheaper. For example, our IT staff, we have two. We are IT-driven. We are data-driven. Everything we do relates to data. And I have looked at but don't see a way that there would be any way that we could move that service outside of the agency. On the other hand, a few years back, the legislature established small agency resource teams in the Department of Administration. They funded some additional positions in the Department of Administration so that that department could take over human resources functions and purchasing transaction functions for small agencies, and we opted into that program. It's part of what helped us get rid of that ninth staff member and restructure our board. And we still make all of our own purchasing and HR decisions, but all of that complex work that has to be done in the state systems is done by the SMART teams for us. And also, they are a resource to make sure that we comply with all the state policies and procedures. So they've added a level of professionalism. And I think there are many state agencies, small agencies, that are in that program, and it certainly merits funding to go forward. Office of Enterprise Technology has also engaged in some initiatives. The state email system is a great example. The one that strikes me as important for our agency is the enterprise license that they entered into with Microsoft, where for only $130 per person in our office, we are guaranteed to always have the most recent versions of Microsoft Office products, Microsoft Windows, and quite a few other Microsoft products. So that's a bargain compared to if we had to go out and purchase those ourselves, even through the state licensing program. What are we thinking about going forward for this legislative session? The board did meet earlier this month and authorized me to proceed with some legislative recommendations. I will be meeting with leadership of the various bodies, the two bodies, also with the chairs of the responsible committees to determine exactly how we'll proceed going forward. But I want to give you just a hint of what we are looking at. We are structuring our recommendations under two themes, service and simplification. And in the area of service, we're looking at actually asking for some additional authority for the board to answer questions that we answer already. We get calls all the time, for example, about disclaimers, and the disclaimer statute isn't in our jurisdiction. So we can tell people what it says, but we really can't help them, and there's nobody that can. If any of you ever called about putting up a sign on corporate property, you probably talked to me, and I would have told you, well, here's the statute, but it's not in our jurisdiction, and you really sort of have to make up your own mind about whether you can do it or not. We think that there ought to be someone who could give you an answer to that question, and in a very limited number of cases, the board is suggesting that it might be the organization that you could go to. Simplification, we're going to be proposing raising the thresholds for registration for certain candidates. Right now, a candidate has to register if they spend $100. A candidate will spend $100 just seeking party endorsement. They may not get that endorsement, and then they're out of the system, and yet they've had to register and report. We think that's probably unnecessary. I'm also raising some thresholds for political committees and funds so that the smallest of them don't have to get into the system. They'll be able to do some limited amount of spending without getting involved with the campaign finance board. I want to conclude with just some discussion about public financing and public subsidy programs in general. I mentioned that in 1974, the federal government and the state following enacted campaign finance regulation Soon thereafter, that was challenged in what is still the premier court case, Supreme Court case regarding campaign finance. It's called Buckley versus Vallejo. Buckley was a senator from New York who was the brother of William F. Buckley, the commentator and editor. Vallejo was a member of the Federal Elections Commission. And that case established several propositions on which our system is based. First of all, that court and court since have said money is speech when it comes to campaign money. So whether you agree with that proposition or not, that's what the court said, really recognizing that in the campaign arena, you can't get your message out adequately if you can't spend money to do it. So money is speech. We have that as a given. The second major proposition that the court established, and it's unchallenged, and I think will never be challenged, is that you cannot limit the amount of money that a candidate can spend on his or her own campaign. And a corollary to that is that you cannot limit the amount of money that a candidate can spend on their campaign at all in general. Now, you might think that's a contradiction. We have spending limits. You all know about your spending limit, or most of you do. Those spending limits in Minnesota and elsewhere where they have them are voluntary. They're based on your agreement. When you sign a public subsidy agreement, the state says, if you sign this agreement, you will get a payment, or at least be eligible for a payment if you meet the other qualifications, from the state in the form of public subsidy money. In exchange for that agreement, you agree, number one, to limit your spending, which we couldn't make you do otherwise, and number two, to limit your own contributions to your campaign, which we couldn't make you do otherwise. The court also held, however, that certain things are permissible even if you don't agree with them. One of those things is that the state can limit individual contributions to candidates. So those individual contribution limits and PAC limits or political committee limits, that aggregate special source limit that you're familiar with, those apply to everybody, whether they sign a public subsidy agreement or not, because the court said you can limit the individual contributions coming in. You just can't limit the total number that a person can take and how much they can spend. And the other thing the court said is you can require disclosure. And so our system is based on a hybrid of all of those things, voluntary limits made possible by public subsidy, because otherwise why would anyone voluntarily limit their spending? And even the public subsidy program is a hybrid. It includes direct payments of public subsidy that the Campaign Finance Board issues to your committee. And at least in the past, it included a contribution refund component, which was another incentive for you to agree to limit your spending limit, your spending. What might happen if we didn't have any public subsidy program? One can only speculate, but we would think that costs of elections would go up. I use an example, and it's no doubt an extreme example, the 6th Congressional District, where the two federal candidates raised more than $15 million in this last election. Now, the House districts, of course, don't match the whole size of the Congressional District, but the candidates in 15B up there, the winning candidate spent just over $25,000, the losing candidate spent just over $13,000, and another candidate who lost the primary spent just over $5,000. So you have only, less than $50,000 in spending in the House district up there. That's because of public subsidy. That's because of the spending limit agreement, which each of those candidates agreed to. Why do candidates even agree to that? Well, first of all, it's a fairly safe system. If you agree and your opponent in the general election didn't agree, you're released from your limit, so it's fairly safe to opt into. Secondly, as I mentioned, the contribution limits, how much you can raise, applies to everybody, whether they agree or not to the public subsidy spending limits. And that includes the limits on those special sources. A study was recently completed. It was based on the 2006 elections of those states whose bodies in the legislature as well as governors were up for election. There were 33 states. In Minnesota, 60% of the money raised by candidates came from individuals who gave $250 or less. 60%. That was the highest percent of any of those 33 states, came from what we would call small donors. The amount of money that came from what we might call large donors, their trigger was $1,000, 24% of that money came from large donors in Minnesota, and that was the smallest percentage in 33 states. Another interesting fact figure is that the percentage of voters or voting age people who gave money to candidates was 4.11%. That was the fourth highest of 33 states. So we have a high percentage of participation, not just in voting, but in donating to candidates. Now, partly that's Minnesota. It might partly be, I suspect it is partly, the public subsidy contribution refund program that existed at that time. Now, you'll have people coming in and arguing both for and against these programs, and I don't intend to argue either way. I will simply say that if you look at the figures, it seems that the concept of limiting campaign spending through a voluntary program with incentives has worked in Minnesota. House races in the $30,000, $35,000 race. I suspect that if that whole system were to go away, those costs would go up significantly. And I expect that if part of that system goes away, as was demonstrated in the last election with the absence of the contribution refund program, we did see some drop in participation. Now, whether it was because of that defunding of the contribution refund program or some other way reason, I cannot tell you. So I think that concludes my remarks. I want to say, how much does it cost? The direct public subsidy, that's the money we pay to you, costs about $3.5 million per biennium, and the contribution refund program costs about $10.5 million. So you've got about $14 million per biennium for the cost of the whole public subsidy program.
Okay, are there any additional questions? Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks a lot for coming to the committee. A couple things. First of all, a comment. We are lucky, in my opinion, in Minnesota that we have these programs in place, because I think the result would certainly be huge inflation on the campaign spending side. That is something that affects all of us. If you talk to friends and colleagues around the country in comparably sized legislative districts, they have often six-figure costs for running for election. In Virginia, I know, I have friends out there for their House of Delegates. I mean, if we didn't have this in place, we would be having multiples of the cost of what every one of us have right now to run our campaigns. So I think that's a good thing. I have a question. The last year, on a bipartisan basis, we passed some, and it was Representative Winkler's bill, we passed some new disclosure requirements for various political committees. We basically made them file more reports. I'm wondering if you could give us a status as to how a status update as to how your office is handling that. Has it been a crushing burden? Has it been manageable? Any comments on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I wouldn't say it was a crushing burden, but it was an unexpected and heavy burden. The timing was very quick. The bill passed at the end of May, and the first report was due, I think, in June or July. I'd have to go back. I always rely on my calendars. I don't rely on my memory. But we had two new reports added, we also had a new whole new type of committee added that hadn't existed before. So not only did we have to develop an additional pre-general election and pre-primary election report and process them as they came in, we also had to develop a whole new set of forms for these independent expenditure political committees and funds. The staff worked extremely hard. I think where we suffered was we were not able to develop documentation and guidance for these new types of committees. I think we were able to integrate the existing committees pretty easily into the system, although there was a great deal of confusion because it was new, and committees had reports due in some cases about 3 weeks apart, and they didn't understand that it was two separate reports. So it was a heavy burden. It will no doubt be easier in the next election cycle, although an additional new report will be required in that election cycle because it was in statute but not effective until the 2012 cycle. So it's been a challenge, and we got through it. We did have to defer some things. For example, the annual report for next fiscal year, for the last fiscal year, we're just moving on now because we simply didn't have the time to do it.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quick. I've heard we have another bill on the calendar today, so I'm sure we want to get to that. But a question for you, Mr. Goldsmith, or maybe it's for Mr. Shepard, I'm not sure, just in terms of the history. You mentioned the Buckley decision and what we can and can't limit in Minnesota and throughout the country. There's one provision, though, that I've been asked about before. I don't know the history of it, and that is the provision that limits the carryover. Does anyone here know, and maybe we can have this discussion offline, what is the history with that, and why is that allowable under Buckley, the idea that all candidates, you can't basically have a war chest. You can only carry over a certain amount into the next year after the election. We can talk offline about that.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Simon. I'm not sure about the constitutional basis for it. I think the reason for it was to get everybody off on a more even footing, but you're correct. Essentially, it's making a candidate give back to the state money that they raised under constitutional guidelines, so I would have to check that.
Okay. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. I've always had good luck when I've called your office, and you've been always very attentive to answer questions for me, and I appreciate that. I just wanted to make clear, we do not have to do campaign finance for municipalities for local elections, right? We don't have any jurisdiction over that, your department?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative McFarland, that's correct. Chapter 211A governs campaign finance for local jurisdictions and candidates, and we do not have jurisdiction
okay.
over that.
And I'm going to bring up an issue that we've talked about before, but I think it was 3 or 4 years ago there was some legislative change where water management organizations was one of the organizations that was affected by this, that people that were appointed to those boards had to file campaign disclosure with as far as their economic interest statements, and there was a lot of flack about that across the state. Do you want to comment on that, if anything's changed or if you have any recommendations?
Mr. Goldsmith?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative McFarland. The controversy hasn't died down, I would say. The opposition to the requirement is still there. Let me just briefly refresh the body's recollection, if you were here then, or inform you as to what we're talking about if you weren't here. The Campaign Finance Board, as I mentioned, collects economic interest disclosure from public officials, essentially stock holdings, land holdings, horse racing holdings, and so on. And to some extent, that's been done for a long time from a lot of officials, including each of you, who might vote on measures that might affect your own personal interests. The purpose of that collection, according to the statute, is so that one can identify potential conflicts of interest. I think it was 2008, but I could be wrong, and I believe it was in a budget bill. Soil and Water Conservation Boards, watershed district managers, and another group of similarly situated officials who are essentially local officials or sort of regional officials were added to the definition of public official. And the board and board staff did not see that one, to be honest with you, going forward, so we didn't have an opportunity to comment on it at that time. But that added about 800 public officials, and almost doubled the number of public officials that were filing with us, and it added 800 people who are not really used to being called public officials. They don't often consider themselves public officials, and they were in some cases outraged and in some cases bewildered about the requirement that they now have to disclose their stock holdings, for example, because they couldn't see a relationship between that and the office that they held. Some resigned completely rather than disclose. Through an educational process, we have got most people on board now. We inform them ahead of time. Those that run for election know ahead of time what the requirement is going to be. But there's still a lot of consternation and a lot of questions about what the benefit of that disclosure is. It took a lot of effort for the board to integrate that into its systems. That has been accomplished now, although that segment of public officials is still one of the segments that generates the most activity at a staff level.
Okay. I think we're going to hold off any
additional.
I just additional
wanted to comment. I have that bill jacketed if anybody wants to sign on to
okay.
it. To
okay.
Fix.
Thank you. All right. We'd like to thank Mr. Goldsmith for his presentation today on the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. I appreciate throughout your presentation you're talking of improving workflow and process, and I think we need to do that constantly. So I appreciate that, and we appreciate you coming before the board today. Seeing that we now have a quorum, we'll officially call the meeting to order. And I would like to Could we get approval of the minutes for our past two meetings, January 11th and 18th? I, Representative Plum, moves approval of the January 11th and 18th minutes. Are there any corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Okay, at this point, I'd like to turn the gavel over to Chairman Pepin.
Representative Downey, I think you're next on the agenda. I just need to take a second to get in my packet. Representative Beard, do you have a question?
I have a motion to make, Madam Chair, if you're ready for one.
Is it relating to Representative Downey's bill?
It is,
okay.
Yes. Madam Chair, I'll move House File 4, recommend its adoption and be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Does that sound like something you'd like to send it to?
That sounds good. Representative Beard moves that House File 4 be recommended to pass and re-referred to State Government Finance. We now have the bill before us. Would you like to proceed on your bill, or do you have an amendment?
Madam Chair, if I could, I believe somebody on the committee might need to also move this for me, but we have the A1 amendment. I think that's the number. Is that, or has it been engrossed into the committee engrossment that we're looking at?
Do we have numbers there? I don't have it in front of me. Just one second. I don't have it in front of me. Okay, Representative Downey has an author's amendment labeled A1. Would someone like to move the author's amendment to put it in the shape he desires?
Madam Chair, I'll be happy to move the H0004A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author wishes.
Okay, Representative Beard moves the A1 amendment. Would you like to describe your amendment, Representative Downey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The purpose of the amendment really is to conform the bill, I'll say more precisely, to our intent. This bill was originally authored last year, and in actually getting it to the state where we can now have a hearing on it, we identified a number of places where greater clarity would be warranted, most notably the provision talking about the bill applying to the executive branch agencies and specifically excluding MNSCU, which is oftentimes interpreted to be included in state government when you talk about state government as a term broadly in statute. And then the rest of the changes are really conforming changes to that and adding a little more precision about the term of the bill and what happens after the end of the 2015 year. So, Madam Chair, I would propose approval of my author's amendment.
Okay, does anyone have discussion? Representative Scalzi.
Yeah, I just have I'm not a lawyer, but I see that the word shall in the bill is changed to must in the A1 amendment. What does that mean?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scalzi. I might defer to Mr. Shepard on this. I know we are trying to, within the revisor's office, have standardized terminology, and I think it's simply a terminology change for consistency, but I'll defer to Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Shepard?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, yes, I agree with what Representative Downey stated, that shall and must are both mandatory, and so it's just a stylistic difference.
Any other questions on the A1 amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Are there other amendments? Oh, you can do that first.
Madam Chair,
please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. If I could just present some of the intent and the specific contents of the bill, and then open it up to questions.
I certainly don't want to suggest that you can't ask a question along the way if there's some, you know, clarification that you need from me in terms of what I'm describing. The real purpose of this bill, I think most people will look at this as some kind of a budget balancing technique, and frankly, the real intent of this bill is to balance government. To balance government with its relation to the private sector, to put it on a structurally sound cost footing, and to address this significant challenge that we have within the state workforce, that fully 50% of our state workforce will reach the age of 60 by the year 2015. And so we have a bubble of employment, kind of an age demographic bubble moving through the state workforce, which if we don't address it, will leave us with an equally imbalanced workforce after those folks retire. And I would suggest that if we don't do anything in terms of reform and redesign and really optimizing what we do in state government, we'll simply hire behind those retirees, and we will lock ourselves into this unsustainable cost structure for the next 30 years. And so I think the time is now to try and do this, and to do it in an intentional and strategic, and I would argue caring for our employees kind of way. You know, we can either wait until we really hit the wall, or we can do this in a planful, intelligent way now in concert with the executive branch and, frankly, deferring a lot of control to the governor. So let me just walk through the bill real quickly, and then we can field some questions and have some discussion. And if there's other testifiers and what have you, we can get to that. So why even do this? If we don't set some kind of a target, I don't feel we'll ever achieve redesign and reform. And anybody who looks at a large-scale organizational project or some kind of a process improvement, somewhere where you're going to try and gain some efficiencies, there is always a combination of people, process, and technology required to get there. And so if we do not address the workforce side, if we simply think that the workforce side of things can stay the way it is, I can tell you we will have a built-in impediment to all of the concrete redesign ideas that we're going to be hearing in our committees and the legislature this year. And in terms of setting an incentive, if you set a goal of let's improve a percent a year, or for every two retirees, let's only hire one back, you're really setting an incremental target that will allow you to simply do what you're currently doing today a little faster, you'll work a little harder, a little bit smarter. You won't get down to the fundamental redesign that I think we need in state government and that we all talk about a lot. So that's one reason why. The second is, absent some kind of a target like this, my own opinion is that we'll continue to stick with the existing state government workforce. And I really think it's time for us to let go of the status quo and the jobs of the past. And I actually have another sequence of bills coming that I think will help us to reinvent state government employment for the 21st century. And we don't need to get into the details of these items, but this target of a 15% reduction goes hand in glove, first, with everything that we're going to propose and try to do as both a legislative and an executive branch in terms of reinventing what we do, and secondly, positioning us for the future and creating a new workforce, a more dynamic workforce, one that is more empowered within the existing structures of state government. So I believe this is the best for our state and the best for our employees. Let's talk a little bit about fiscal realities. This is a chart that shows our general fund spending going all the way back to 86 and 87. The blue graph represents our actual general fund spending. Obviously, in this biennium and next, it's projected. The yellow bar says that if we went back to 1986 and projected forward, increasing our state general fund expenditures at the rate of inflation and population growth, what we would be spending out of our general fund right now. Members, we would have a surplus, not a deficit, if we had increased our state general fund spending at the rate of population growth and inflation. Same chart for all funds. Many folks watching or listening might not realize that our general fund is just a little over 50% of total state expenditures. Same graph. If you look at the blue bars, that's what we spend all funds when you include the highway fund and the healthcare access fund and all the other dedicated funds. And the green bars represent what it would be had we increased total statewide spending at the rate of inflation and population growth. So members, we have created a spending environment and a cost of government, structural environment, that is breeding these increases that, regardless of whether the economy improved or tanked or not, and regardless of whether it improves or not, is literally unsustainable. Another chart to take a look at is employment. When you look at our private sectors by industry sector and realize the kind of decimation that we've had in employment there, and then realize that in the government sector and in those sectors that are largely funded via entitlements by government, we've actually seen the reverse trend. More telling, this workforce table right from the DEED website shows that our overall state government employment has actually been increasing over the last 3 years. This actually includes, this roughly $100,000 number includes 60,000 employees of the MNSCU system, which actually in the last couple of years has begun reducing their employment. So when you look at the executive branch agencies, the focus of this bill, leaving out the higher ed system, the state employees in the higher ed system, you can see that our at best, state government employment has stayed flat at a time when every other area is decreasing. And I know others are going to talk about various ratios about how we're the 10th best when you look at the number of state employees per 10,000 people living in the state. You know, I took a look at the way the census actually tracked that figure. First of all, I took a snapshot, supposed snapshot in March. So it's 1 month. It doesn't average it over the entire year. So you get a very isolated snapshot. It includes all kinds of things like utility employees and wastewater and all of these things. And we're not comparing apples to apples state to state. And you look at the Taxpayers Alliance ratings, and we at one point were 22nd most efficient, and now the census comes out and says that we're, whatever, 10th most efficient. You know, we can come up with all the ratios we want, and state government is really great at coming up with ratios that present a favorable picture. But the reality of how many people we employ is really the only number that counts. And if you look at these statistics, you cannot go out to the DEED website and poke around in our employment data and see any other trend than a dramatic increase over the last 10 years and at best flat, maybe a tiny decrease in certain subsectors of government employment. So what I'm trying to suggest here is that we can get all confused by ratios and things. Just look at the raw data, members. You just can't ignore this. And I would also suggest that when we're talking about comparing our state in terms of workforce efficiency and effectiveness to other states, that's probably the wrong benchmark. I think we ought to be looking at companies like Best Buy or 3M or Medtronic, some of these private giants that we have here in our state, and say, how are we doing compared to them? Because I think that's really the opportunity that we have before us. This is a chart referencing what I mentioned, that we have a demographic bubble moving through our state workforce. You can see the four lines from 1984, 1994, 2000, and 2010. And you can see that, I don't know if it's a baby boomer bubble or what it is, but there is an aging demographic that continues moving through our workforce. And I think, as I mentioned, 50% of our state workforce is going to hit the age of 60 over the next 4 years by the end of 2015. So what we're proposing in this bill, and I'll use just blunt terms, is not to gut state government employment. It's not to whack public sector employees. Frankly, I think there's been plenty of demagoguery on the left towards very successful people in Minnesota supposedly not wanting to pay their fair share, and there's been plenty of demagoguery on the right suggesting that the source of all our problems are these good-for-nothing state employees who are simply milking the system. And I think we need to get beyond that and look at what I think is a creative partnership between the legislative branch and the executive branch to deal with that demographic bubble, to provide a structural redesign of our workforce in a way that positions us effectively for the future as a state and deals fairly with the state employees. And so, absent setting a target, I don't think we'll get anywhere. How do we get there? I'm proposing that the legislature would give the governor a set of tools. Furloughs, cuts, wage freezes, benefit restructuring, and an early retirement option that's actually included in this bill. Frankly, we've got 4 years to do this. We're trusting that Governor Dayton would do this intelligently, strategically, with proper care for the priorities of the citizens of Minnesota and for the proper needs and concerns of the state workforce. The early retirement program I'll talk a little bit about because it is different than what we passed last time. And without going deep into the details, if you'd like to have a more substantive discussion about the program, I'm told we had about 800 people who signed up for the early retirement program that Representative Carlson passed last time. And this early retirement program is designed to get to a higher number of folks than that. I think realistically, I mean, ideally you might offer it to 5,000 state employees and maybe you'd have half of those people taking advantage of it. And there's some costs and some challenges to that, and we'll talk about that in a little bit here. Very importantly, the second 2 points at the very bottom. This early retirement requires an actuarial analysis to be done by management and budget before we implement to determine what the impact is going to be on our pension funds. We all know that we've got an unbalanced liability situation in our pension funds, and we certainly don't want to drive that into an even worse state by virtue of this early retirement program. So before we actually implement the early retirement program, we'd know what the potential impact, we'd model what the potential impact is on our pensions and make sure that the savings, to the extent that they're needing to be returned to our pension funds to make sure they don't become even more unfunded, that would be part of the utilization of the savings. The rest of it could be dropped to the bottom line on the general fund. The second component is we have to enact a hiring freeze, and frankly, this has to be in force after the year 2015 as well. Otherwise, we'll simply just kind of delay and then ramp right back up after 2015. Real briefly, we're one of the few states that hasn't done any of this. Looking at a NASBO NGA survey, 25 states have done layoffs. 22 states have done furloughs, 7 early retirement and salary reductions. And Minnesota effectively has utilized none of the above. Other states' early retirement programs, Illinois put one in place in 2002. Significant savings dropped to their bottom line. Again, we're going to have to be careful here because we're not prescribing exactly how the governor would do this. We're giving him the tools to do it intelligently. So modeling the savings from this is going to be a little bit of art and science. I have requested a fiscal note, and we'll be presenting that when presumably we'd have the chance to hear the bill in state government finance. Iowa just implemented a program, and their participation was, I'll say, off the charts. They offered an early retirement benefit to 2,700 employees. 2,200 of them took advantage of it, and interestingly, Iowa's largest public employee union called it a win-win. New York is doing something similar. They're projected to save $320 million. By the end of fiscal year 2012. Obviously, we're a much smaller state and workforce, so trying to project savings like that is a little difficult. If you take a very simple equation of 15% reduction in the state workforce, you can derive a number of about $300 to $400 million of savings per biennium that conceivably could drop to the general fund bottom line. I'm a little concerned that we wait until the governor has done their actuarial analysis and determine to what extent to implement the program before we book any savings. But very clearly, even in this biennium, a proposal like this could generate in the tens of millions of dollars in the biennium that we're budgeting for now, and after that, even greater, literally in the hundreds of millions. I don't need to go into the details. The bill last year, Representative Carlson's bill that actually ended up being Senate File 1481 when I think it was woven into the final budget deal, allowed a two-year continuing state payment to the employees' health care savings plan, and again, that generated participation of 800 employees. We would be looking for participation in the maybe 2,000 to 4,000 range in the early retirement program we're defining. So in summary, you know, if we do nothing, we're going to hit a wall. Frankly, I think you could argue that we aren't doing our citizens, the state, or our employees any favors by sitting here and just waiting for this to happen. It optimizes our workforce for the future, positions us to really realize significant redesign, reform, and savings. And I just can't stress enough that the purpose here is to do this intentionally and strategically and flexibly in concert with Governor Dayton. And we're setting an outcome measure. how often do we define inputs and never really achieve outcomes in state government? All the time. So I know it's a little bit different to think about. I know it seems a little tough, and it is a line in the sand. But if we don't do it as management, as the board of directors of state government, I don't think we're fulfilling our obligations to our employees and to our state and to our citizens. So I think this is for the good of Minnesota, for the good of our employees, and given the state's imbalanced workforce right now and unsustainable cost structure, I think we would be somewhat negligent not to try and address this. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, members. We'll start with Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Representative Downey, this is a great first step. I think you've laid out a lot of good ideas here. I'm just a little concerned, and my number one thing was the absence of a fiscal note. We may be premature passing this to the state government committee without the fiscal note, or maybe pass it on without comment. But, you know, we don't generally work with a line in the sand type bills. It's we generally work in reality here. I guess I'm a little concerned with what might happen given our large budget deficit this year, what our finance department might determine that the costs would be this year. So that's one point. I have another question, though. By bypassing the pension commission, I'm not sure that we're maybe overstepping our bounds here. I think that, you know, we had such a good presentation yesterday regarding pensions, and I think we've got the people here in the audience today, and I think we're bypassing that step, and there's quite a bit in here. And maybe that's the only area that this committee should really look at is the pension part of it, because there was a bill introduced yesterday about a salary and wage freeze, and it went right to the state government finance committee. So does this... Are we maybe taking on some of this bill when it should go to state government and finance, and maybe we should only be addressing the pension part of it, which might be under our purview? So that's just some of the questions. I've got a lot of them, but that's just some of them.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi, and I'll turn it over to Representative Downey in a minute. About your question about the fiscal note, just keep in mind this is a policy committee, so I think it's entirely appropriate that we consider it here, and then they will, I'm sure, in state government finance want to see that fiscal note. And perhaps regarding the other question, I think that anything has to do with policy can be heard here, and maybe Representative Downey would like to add on to that and answer your question. Representative Downey?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi. Great questions. You'll notice in what I guess in my bill is Subdivision 10, and I don't have my author's amendment, so it might be a new subdivision. But we very specifically, I think, do address the pension fund implications, A, by requiring the actuarial analysis before implementation of any early retirement program under this article. Secondly, specifically requiring that the savings generated would drive to the pension fund first, so that we would not turn it upside down more than it already is by virtue of this. And so perhaps the omission of a reference to the pension commission somehow, we might want to think about whether the pension commission needs to somehow be referenced in here. It was not my intent that we would drive all this back to the pension commission before approving it. That having been said, I share your it's not even a concern, but the fact that oftentimes in policy committees, and we ran into this all the time in K-12 policy last year, where you're asked to consider and debate in a policy committee the policy dimensions of a bill, and then the finance committee deals with the finance implications of the policy implications. So I share some of your frustration on that. It happens a lot. My hope was that this is a fairly significant policy bill. Think about the policy implications here and about the change we could drive and the redesign and the positive things that are facilitated by this. And it seemed best to me to bring it through the policy committee before trying to just run it through the finance committee, which I think would seem a little bit like an end around to this committee.
Representative Nelson? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Scalzi, did that meet your...
Can I do one
follow-up question. Sure.
Thank you. And I noticed that the elected officials are not impacted with this. It's a little troubling to me because at the time that we're doing redistricting, all sorts of things in the state, if we really wanted to save some money, I think we could cut the size of our elected officials And that might be something, I mean, I hate to be an elected official and then, as a matter of policy, exempting us from these severe cuts, because a 15% cut, I mean, if you leave out prison guards and sex offender hospitals and nursing home inspectors, I mean, we're really talking about maybe 20%. I don't know what that percent would be, but there's some departments of the state that we would not be able to exempt from this, and because they're essential services. So I think that has to be worked through and maybe presented. It's not really 15%. I think in most departments it would be 20 or maybe even higher. Have you thought of that, and have you thought of not exempting elected officials?
Thank you, Representative Scalzi. I think you make a good point about the elected officials. And I do also want to point out, and I'm sure Representative Downey will talk about this, that I think he's done a good job of, in this bill, of laying out that this would give the governor tools to be able to, it doesn't, it's not anything that would require him to do anything specifically. So that's the aspect of the bill that I like, that it would allow for a lot of different options, and it would allow for him to look at those and have power over and some control over how that would happen. Did you want to comment on that, Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi. Yeah, we think a lot alike. I give some consideration to including other constitutional offices and other, you know, domains of state government in this, and chose to bring it right back down to the executive branch agencies. Just in terms of the span and scope of the bill, the number of committees that we'd have to go through, and frankly, there's a lot of other work to be done by our committees on our own legislative budget, for example. And some of your comments are right on. You might be interested in signing on to a bill that I signed on to that actually does reduce the size of the legislature as we go through redistricting. And you might be interested in signing on to a bill that I've authored that will be controversial on both sides of the aisle, to reduce legislator salaries by 5% and our per diems by 15%, to show an additional participation, kind of lead by example, start with us proposals. And I do know, as part of, I think, the finalization of the rules, I believe the majority caucuses in both the House and the Senate are thinking about other ways for the legislature to participate in this reduction. We've already realized a 35% reduction in our committee sizes and staffs. I think on the House side, we've addressed our housing reimbursements. On the Senate side, they've reduced their per diems. So I guess, did I consider including the legislature? Yes. I think given that there's a number of other bills and a number of other things happening, not to prescribe it here and let that process play forward. With regard to those other kind of classes, should we carve out certain sectors of employment? I thought about that too. But almost every example you can come up with, you know, number one, I think we need to trust the judgment of the governor on this. I mean, even since I've been here in the last 2 years, we saw a bill to privatize a prison. You know, if we start consolidating 911, doing shared services around police functions, the issue of, you know, three different levels of government having a snowplow drive through the same neighborhood. And so you can think of all of these things that you might want to protect. And yet, all of a sudden, we start protecting and creating these sacred cows, and you're going to shut down redesign. Representative McFarland had a local government collaboration. We had a group. We had a commission on service innovation. We've got dozens and dozens of bills coming that are all getting at these issues of how do we get better across layers of government and within state government. And to do these carve-outs, in my mind, we'd run the risk of shutting down all kinds of innovations and, frankly, tying the hands of the governor, who ultimately has to run these executive branch operations. So I think in terms of our participation as a legislature through this bill, collaborating with the governor, I think this is the right scope and the right constraints in the bill.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Downing. As I look at this and I listen to your testimony, to me it seems like you've kind of got the cart before the horse. And we cut the employees, but we're not cutting any
thing that they have to do, so we're just going to have less employees doing more. It reminds me of a cartoon that I cut out years back and I've got up in my desk drawer showing a chief executive sitting at the front of the board table and one employee sitting there with the computer in front of him and piles stacked around him, and the caption goes, well, now that we've taken care of costs, we got to deal with the fact that production's gone through the floor. I think what we need to do if we're going to be doing this type of thing is looking at what services are we going to go cut out? I mean, because there are things, if we cut 15% of the employees and these people are gone, there's things that they're doing that aren't going to get done. We should be looking at what services or whole service departments that we have that we don't think we need anymore, and make that, have that as a discussion, and it probably should be an open discussion, that something we could have. It's something I've said in the past, that we should have that discussion all the time. But if we're not cutting services and just piling more work on the existing employees, it's kind of like what the gentleman that testified here before us from the Campaign Finance Board. There's things that, because of some of the reports that we put on them, they had to put off a report till later that they couldn't get done because they didn't have time to do it. There's only so many hours in a day, and there's so much work an individual employee can do, and technology can help increase some of that, but it's still, at some point, we get to the point where, what aren't we going to be doing and that we need to get done, or that our constituents and our citizens of the state of Minnesota want us to get done, because we've cut 15% of our employees out. And I think, like I said, I think we've got the cart here before the horse. We're not talking about both sides of that equation. You can't just cut people without cutting what these people were doing and what's not going to get done now.
Representative Downey.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Nelson, excellent points. And let me try to answer it a couple of different ways. One, let's just talk concretely about proposals that I think you're going to see from the legislature this year. Representative Pepin, if she hasn't authored it already, is going to be reauthoring her Sunset Commission. I have a bill that will consolidate the core technology management functions into OET, so we don't have them distributed and redundantly managed. I have a bill that I'm drafting that'll, on the heels of our SWIFT accounting system implementation, create a shared service center for administrative back office functions, which many large organizations have done. I think if you take a look at the bills that we've authored, there are going to be a ton of concrete examples of how we're going to get to this, how we're going to actually position state government to do it. I would argue, and I think this is true in the private sector as well as the public sector, sorry to use a crude term, but unless you starve the beast by cutting their appropriations or set some kind of a hard metric like this, you're never going to drive to those kinds of redesign and those kinds of changes. You just aren't. It's human nature. People, process, and technology are all required for this kind of redesign in state government. So that's one answer. The second is, I just couldn't agree with you more. Representative Banyan has a priority-based budgeting bill, and I think at the very top, we need to sit down and say, all right, we've got a $1.5 billion increase in our general fund revenues this year. We're going to have $32 billion to spend. How are we going to hold ourselves in the executive branch accountable for where we spend that? How are we going to prioritize the distribution of that increase, and how are we going to manage that $32 billion expenditure? And again, when you look at the totality of state government, we're talking about $60 billion. So I couldn't agree with you more in terms of setting priorities and having an overall management framework that looks at what are we doing and why are we doing it. And I think you're going to see from the majority a lot of very specific tools and concrete ways to get there, and this has got to be one component of it.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up question, Representative Nelson? Okay. We'll move on to Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Downey, I appreciate the spirit of reform and redesign and accountability. I think we all do. We always have to be striving to make government perform better and ultimately be accountable. So I do appreciate that, but you know, we can have a lot of battles with statistics here, and I wanted to set the record straight on one thing. And you remember from a couple years ago, Representative Downey, every time during new member orientation, and the five here on this committee who just went through it remember this, there's always a presentation by Bill Marks, the senior fiscal analyst, and he always shows two versions of charts. the liberals love one and the conservatives love the other. You included the conservative charts. Obviously, you didn't include the liberal ones. The conservative ones are the ones on page 2 that show this supposedly out-of-control government spending. The ones that the rest of the folks like is the one that shows the cost of government over the same period, the last 20 or 25 years, absolutely the same. Absolutely the same. The cost of government meaning the percentage of personal income that goes to state and local taxes. It is the same as it was 20 years ago. So I don't think we should mislead Minnesotans. There's more than one way to look at this, and I don't think any one side has cornered the market on truth, but I think it's fair to introduce that into it. So by one measure, we don't have an out-of-control spending problem. And I think the acid test from a standpoint of just reality, not theory but reality, is Tim Pawlenty. You know, whether you agree or disagree with Tim Pawlenty, I think he would call himself a fiscal conservative's fiscal conservative. He is proudly making the rounds of Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, bragging as his calling card that he is the one who held the line and was fiscally responsible. That is his brand. And I don't think he would have signed into law any budget that he thought would be unsustainable and put us on a chart towards runaway unsustainable growth. He would not have done that. I don't think he would have been overridden, those of us who served at the time. So to say that the budgets over the last few years have been somehow irresponsible or they've ushered in an era of uncontrolled growth is to say that Tim Pawlenty, in essence, is not being truthful when he says that he held the line, that he was undisciplined, that he was weak. And I don't think on these issues he was. I'm not trying to fight past battles. I'm trying to say that I think it's a little disingenuous to suggest somehow that we're on this unsustainable path in terms of our general budget. So my question for you is, do you know recently, or what are the latest statistics, what percentage of state general spending or all fund spending is people, payroll? Do you know?
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I will address this question, and then if I could, I'd also like to address some of the comments as well. I don't have an exact number, but when you look at all fund spending, the majority of it is going to go to pass through entitlement expenditures. The remainder of that, when you look at the operational side of government, about 80% is people. And in the bill that we're proposing, there is about, I think, $2.9 billion worth of payroll expenditure that we're talking about here, and a potential savings, you know, somewhere around the 10 to 15% of that. So I think that's how we get to these numbers. Regarding some of your suppositions and comments, and I'm not sure we want to go down this rabbit hole, but I will tell you, as a ordinary citizen who never spent any time down here before running for office, and coming down and hearing the statistics that get bandied about, you know, my eyes pop out of my head. I mean, I come from an environment where you look at the checkbook. I mean, it's pretty simple. The checkbook is right up here. How many people do we have? I mean, the university professors and the state government administrators are great at coming up with all these ratios, and you mentioned the price of government. I mean, talk about a flawed metric. That price of government is a ratio of the cost of government divided by gross or personal income. You know what's included in personal income? All government employees. So we've got the cost of government in the numerator and the cost of 80% of the cost of government in the denominator. Guess what? It's always going to be understated. Any increase in state spending increases the numerator and denominator. You can't even do it in Excel. It's a circular reference. So I think we got to be really careful when we say that there are always two versions of the truth. I don't know if I agree with that. I'm going to go with the plain and simple. State government spending has increased twice the rate of the rest of the economy over the last 25 years. You can try and explain it away. You can try and come up with some ratios. You could probably do that for my stock portfolio and show me that I did really great over the last 3 years. But it's not true. Cash on hand, cash in the bank, the actual expenditures is what we've got to deal with. And if we don't come to grips with this, all we're doing is we're sending this downstream again. The time is now. Actually, the time was 2 years ago. And we didn't do it. We got the stimulus money, and we didn't do it. We skated by. And with regard to your comments about Governor Pawlenty, tell you what, if Governor Pawlenty's proposed budgets had ever been implemented by the Democratic legislature, we would not be in this situation.
Thank you,
Representative Simon. Well, do you have a follow-up question?
I would just say this: it's too bad that you don't see that there are different versions of the truth, and I think that's unfortunate. I do. I think there's a lot of gray, and not just black and white. And it's unfortunate that you take that position. I do think that I defer to Bill Marx and others who use those figures, and I think most of us hold them in very high regard. But I would say this: you said that 80% of the rest is people. The figures that I've heard is that the cost in people, just of the general funds budget, not all funds, but general funds budget, is somewhere in the low double digits. So I think, again, I'm not saying that what you're trying to accomplish is unworthy. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, you talked about myths, and I appreciate your honesty. One prevailing myth on the right is, as you yourself mentioned, that somehow state employees are the cause of our current budget problems, and that is just not the case. It just is not the fact. Evidence is not socialism. Evidence is for everyone. And evidence says that when you're saving 10 or 15% of 10 or 15%, that's a pretty small number. Now, it may be worth doing for other reasons, and I don't question your motives on that. I don't. I've served with you on committees, and I know that you sincerely want to do what's best for the state, and you want redesign and accountability, and I do appreciate that. And you've been a real leader on those issues. But we can't mislead people to think that this is a way to meaningfully impact our budget question. We could pink slip every single state employee, every single one of them. We have crickets chirping at the DNR, Department of Agriculture, Department of Revenue, and that alone wouldn't solve our problems. So I just want to make sure we're not being dishonest with people and raising hopes or expectations. So if the reason that you're doing this is you think there's some other reason that we're going to achieve some level of dynamism or accountability or redesign for its own sake, and that we'll be able to give Minnesotans what they say they want in a more efficient way, that's great. And I think we should always strive to do that, whether it's through this bill or another. And I think that you sincerely want to do that. But if this is a budget balancer, it's a bust. And I just think we need to be clear with people about that, for those out there who believe something. And another thing, Representative Downey, you mentioned about the world that you come from. Well, most of us, including myself, are in the private sector as well in our other lives. And in the private sector, it's pretty much reversed. In the private sector, people costs are 80, 85, sometimes a larger percentage of costs in the private sector, and it's pretty much reversed here in the state. We are basically a repository for money that funnels in and then funnels out based on various formulas, as you know, serving on the committees that you do. So unlike the private sector, we do not have 80 or 85 or 90% of our costs in people. It's really the opposite. So I think at some point that becomes apples and oranges, and I just want to be clear with people and set expectations for Minnesotans that we can save 10 or 15% of 10 or 15% here, and we should always be cost conscious and looking for savings, but let's not mislead people about the true budget balancing impact here.
Thank you, Representative Simon. And I have to say, for one, that I think, Representative Downey, you've done a good job of saying that this isn't the only solution. I mean, the majority is trying to put together a whole bunch of ideas and trying to work with the governor's office as he prepares to give us his ideas by February 15th. And I don't think that Representative Downey has characterized this as the end-all, be-all solution. This is just one of the many tools that we hope to put forward and that we hope to work with the minority on, because this problem that we have with the budget shortfall is not just the Republicans and it's not just the Democrats, it's all of us together. And I appreciate that you were willing to bring this forward, Representative Downey, and if you have additional comments, that would be great. We have a few more questions, and I'm guessing we're going to have some amendments, so I'd like to kind of move it on and try to keep personalities out of it to the extent that we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will just re-echo. I hope one of the first things that came out of my mouth is that this is not a budget-balancing bill. I know many of the opponents are going to try and frame it that way to describe its inadequacies. If this were a budget-balancing bill, I would have built into the statute some predefined model for how we'd get at the savings, and I would have had a fiscal note for you and come in and said, listen, we can whack $300 million out of our next fiscal biennial budget, and we did not. This is a set of tools for the governor to achieve an overall strategic structural reduction in our workforce, which does have budgetary benefits. And, if this were the private sector, we wouldn't be doing this over 4 years. We'd be doing this over 3 to 6 months, maybe 12 months. And so I think this is a very reasonable plan. The objectives peripherally are to help with the budget deficit, directly they are to optimize our workforce, directly they are to position our state for future success.
Okay. I'm going to move on. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a couple of, I guess the underlying question I have is that you just said that this, the goal is to optimize the workforce, to make sure that the state is on a structurally sound footing. You made some other comments that we're going to hit a wall. What analysis did you use to arrive at a 15% reduction, and what kind of basis is that for determining what the optimal level of workforce is at the state? In my experience here, if we're going to implement budget cuts of 15%, the way to do that would be to work through the committee process and reduce appropriations and have committees work with agencies, work with advocates, work with all kinds of people, the public, to figure out the way to reduce the budget. It's similar, I think, in redesign. If you want to redesign the Department of Human Services, just telling them to cut 15%, it seems to me, isn't really a very helpful set of guidance. So if you want to use the charts and statistics that you prefer, how did you get to 15%?
Representative Winkler, I'll turn that over to Representative Downey in a second, and I think that we share some of the same ideas, so I hope you'll be interested in working on some of the government redesign stuff that we're looking at, because I think we do need to address those issues. Representative Downey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, the shortest answer is we have a 15% budget deficit. We had a 15% budget deficit issue last time around, and it's roughly the same here this time around as well. And so assuming that kind of all functions and components of state government would participate roughly equally in that, I thought 15% was a decent number. If somebody wanted to propose a different number, I'd be willing to listen and talk. It's also a little bit based on my professional experience consulting to state and local governments, and frankly thinking that 15% efficiency gain in these very large bureaucracies is probably very modest in terms of a target.
Representative Winkler, a quick follow-up, but I am trying to move this along so that we can move forward with the bill today.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I waited patiently for my turn. So it sounds to me that the 15% number is sort of one that you picked, and on the one hand, you want to use hard numbers to describe a problem from your perception, but you want to provide a simple answer, a simple number that you've kind of plucked from air to prescribe the solution and say that that's right-sizing, that's making it structurally sound, et cetera. What I'm concerned is that you're sidestepping the reform process. I know you want to set a target, but this bill doesn't set a target. This bill implements a reduction in force of 15%, and you provide some tools and statute that the governor may or may not already have, and we'll get to the pensions question. But all you're doing is really just cutting workforce. You're not redesigning anything. And I know that when we actually engage in this work, I know that you'll have bills. Some bills that you'll present will be for political purposes, and we all do that. Some bills that you present will be actually bipartisan reform efforts. And I frankly think the 15% across-the-board reduction, without any reference to the hard work it takes, and I know you know it takes hard work, to actually redesign services and to identify priorities, is the kind of statement that you make in the first 10 bills that you introduce, which was, you know, it's House File 4. The real reform probably comes in House File 400, and I look forward to actually working on that. I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer, but I can wait until discussion is over. Oh, but I have a question for you, Madam Chair. And this should go to Representative Beard. I'm concerned that we have a bill that deals with pensions that is not going to the Pension Commission. And I wonder if it's in order to re-refer, to amend the motion to re-refer to the Pension Commission rather than moving it to State Government Finance.
Representative Winkler, I don't believe that's in order because we do have jurisdiction over pensions, so that is not necessary.
But, Madam Chair, do we have assurance from you or Representative Downey that at some point this bill will visit the Pension Commission? When I carried a bill on the Iran divestment, we started out in the committee process, and we had to go to pensions in order to pass that into law. I think that's an important part of the process. So I guess if we don't do it, if we send it to State Government Finance now, that's fine, but I think there should be a commitment that this bill will see jurisdiction of the Pensions Commission before it is sent to the floor.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. We will take that under advisement, and at this point we'll continue the motion to go to state government. Representative Hornstein, I think this is the last member. I know that there are a few more questions, if we could maybe hold off a little bit. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Just a quick one. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Downey. I was struck in your presentation. You used the term in the context of redesign of looking at jobs of the past in state government. And so I thought about, the committee, the jurisdiction that I'm most familiar with, transportation, and I was wondering if you thought, for example, a snowplow driver is a job of the past or a state trooper is a job of the past. What do you mean by that?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Somebody's got to sit in the vehicle and drive the plow. I'm not sure that we need three people sitting in vehicles driving past each other in the same neighborhood simply because there's different jurisdictions for the roads that they're plowing. So I think there's an optimization opportunity there. I think more importantly, I'll just give you an example in testimony last year or 2 years ago in state government finance when there had been some breach of security and somebody had absconded with funds, I think, in Health and Human Services. I don't remember the exact number, but there were somewhere north of 20 different functions in the Department of Health and Human Services processing accounts receivable. And there were limited accounting controls on some number of them, obviously, for the fraud to have taken place. And so we're implementing a new accounting system today that, on many different fronts, has automated processes, electronic routing of approvals, and do you really need 25 different departments with staff and supervisors and management controls and audit reports and all of that when you have a technology solution and an ability to probably consolidate accounts receivable processing across all executive branch agencies? So that's the kind of thinking I'm talking about when we think about jobs of the future, leveraging the technology, leveraging process change, thinking differently about our organization, and not simply being constrained by the existing structures that are literally industrial age in their formation. So that's more what I'm thinking.
Okay, well, just quickly, Madam Chair, I think we have to be very careful on this because we had the blizzard in early December, for example, and interstate highways, state highways. That's very clear. That's the jurisdiction. It's a state government. It's not shouldn't be the city of St. Paul plowing I-94. And I don't think that anyone would argue that we had too many snowplow drivers or we have too many state troopers in these kind of situations. So I think we have to be very, very careful about how we discuss people's jobs and whether they're relevant for whether they're in the past somehow or relevant for our state currently and in the future.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. I think at this point we'll take there's a few people that have asked to testify in the audience. Mr. Stanton and Dave Bergstrom, if you want to come forward now. I think we're going to limit this to about 3 minutes each since time is dwindling, and if you could state your name and the organization you're with for the tape.
Madam Chair, members, Russ Stanton. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. We are the union for the faculty at the seven state universities. Here to testify against the legislation. I can shorten this up a lot because I was about to just point out that we've already done about almost a 10% reduction in faculty positions in this academic year, and that we also have very rapidly grown enrollment since 2005. We have about 22,500 students. That's like three state universities, and that had to be taken into account, but I realize that Amendment A1 does take Minsky out of the bill. We are still affected, however, by the provision in paragraph 1 dealing with defined benefit versus defined contribution plans. I think for those of you who don't know me, I've been around for a long time, and I have probably been the chief advocate over the years for defined contribution plans. In 1989, our organization came forth and requested a defined contribution plan for our faculty. We lobbied that through the legislature. It's about 85% of our new faculty go into that plan. And for us, it's a very good fit. I would very, very strongly, however, not support the idea that's proposed here of moving all employees to defined contribution plans. What's appropriate for higher education, where defined contribution plans are the norm and where faculty are fairly mobile, is certainly not appropriate for civil service employees or career K-12 teachers. And it just, they're not appropriate. This is something that affects, you know, involves tens of billions of dollars. It affects hundreds of thousands of public employees. And before we do something that would pull the rug out from under, I mean, our older faculty are still in a defined benefit plan. Before we pull the rug out from under them at the end of their career after they've worked on a promise all their career, I really think that we need to study this issue carefully and thoughtfully. Last session, the legislature did, at the in the pension bill, put forth a study to do just that. And the results of that study are going to be due at the end of this year. And I really would hope that before we make a decision that defined contribution plans are the best thing for everybody, that we would wait for the results of that plan and or that study and make a more thoughtful decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bergstrom.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I'm not here to speak for or against the bill, but I did want to talk about the substantial pension cost. And I do appreciate the fact that the savings come back to us is part of the bill, but I do want to temper kind of the short-term savings expectations. And I also want to make it clear that it's going to be very hard for us to do a fiscal note because the bill is fairly vague in how many people would use it. So I just did one calculation, and it's just a factual calculation. I took a state employee, age 55, with 20 years of service, and a high five salary of $45,000. Under current law, the person would be eligible for $685 per month. Under the provision in front of you, the retirement would not be reduced. The benefit would then grow to $1,275 a month. And that has a present value cost of about $98,000 for the one person, which represents about 2 years of salary and benefit savings. And my only point I'm trying to make here is the short-term savings, if I understand the bill right, a lot of that is going to come back to the Minnesota State Retirement. I hope it comes back to the Minnesota State Retirement System to make sure our plan remains funded, and that's my whole sort of purpose here. The bill does allow people to retire at age 50, which in that example would drive up the cost. It allows them to purchase service. I did a purchase of service example. Somebody buying 5 years, the cost to the person would be about $11,000. The cost to the pension plan for that $45,000 a year employee would be in the $50,000 to $60,000 range. So I guess all I'm requesting is that as this bill moves forward, I'd like to be part of the discussion of the funding to make sure that MSRS remains solidly funding. I spoke yesterday, we're coming back, and that's good news, but I want to keep that momentum going. But I did want to raise at least sort of the short-term expectations of savings in this bill, because a lot of it is going to come back to the Minnesota State Retirement System.
Thank you. I think we're going to take one more witness, Julie Blyle from AFSCME, I believe. It doesn't look like Julie Blyle.
I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the
UNSC. Okay, please state your name and for the record. And please limit it to just a few minutes. We're running really short on time now.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I'm Elliot Side. I'm the Executive Director of AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 state, local, and nonprofit employees, and about 17,900 state workers for this piece. Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me first state very clearly that on behalf of our members in the state workforce, we want government to be as efficient as possible. We thrive and work for that every single day. I do want to point out that experts agree that making state government more efficient will cut costs by only 2% at most, and that comes from Republican and Democratic former finance commissioners. However, we believe it is very much worth the effort because taxpayers, and our members are taxpayers too, deserve the best possible government services for their hard-earned dollars. Frontline workers know best how to do that, and we want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. I will point out to the committee, Madam Chair, that in the 80s, it was with a collaborative effort by government and the government workforce that we completely transform the delivery of the developmental disability system in the state from state big state institutions into state-operated community facilities so that we could offer the best therapeutic assistance to developmentally disabled patients. That was a collaboration that was done between the employees of the state and the state governor. And also in transportation, Representative Hornstein had pointed out, Madam Chair, that there are issues in transportation, that in order to make sure that we were able to deliver transportation services most effectively, the union worked with management, in this case an independent governor and then a Republican governor, to do a broadbanding of work so that we have a transportation specialist series now that does it. However, we still have a problem. We have more plows than we have people to run the plows. That's a difficult piece. I did want to point out, if I might, that on average our members make $38,000 a year, and that we are, I'm sorry that it's a fact, by the census, that we are the 10th leanest workforce in the nation. We have 71 public workers for every 10,000 residents. We're tied with conservative Florida. And under Governor Pawlenty in the last 8 years, 11% of the state workforce has been cut, and as a result, AFSCME has lost 1,590 members. So we have had cuts over the last 8 years, and it was done by Governor Pawlenty with this state legislature. Those are a couple of points that I wanted to make. I also I find it difficult to say the private sector would cut all these folks in 12 months. That's why we're in a recession. I don't understand, Madam Chair and members of the committee, of an economic recovery proposal that says we're going to add layoffs of 5,250 people. That's what 15% of the state workforce is. That we're going to add layoffs of 5,250 people without cutting customers on Main Street. Every time we cut a public worker, we cut a customer on Main Street, particularly in greater Minnesota, where the public workforce is a larger share of the local economy. So I fail to see the economics of doing this. I do want to say we want to work on reform. I should point out to the committee, Madam Chair, that the issue of furloughs is a subject of collective bargaining, and in fact have been proposed by Governor Pawlenty, that early retirement, even though it's been done by this legislature, is a mandatory subject of bargaining, can be done, and is already a tool. And as for wage freeze, under Governor Pawlenty and the state workforce, we not only have cut our workforce, but we've had wage freezes in four of the last 8 years under the governor, under former Governor Pawlenty. For the last 8 years, we've had wage freezes. And that's been the case in Hennepin County, St. Louis County, and all kinds of jurisdictions throughout the state. So I want to make it clear that the state workforce is prepared to step up and do what it can. But it has also made sacrifices already. We want the most efficient government possible. And the way to do that is to collaborate with the state workforce, not put fear into its heart. The great post-war economist Demings, who helped the post-war recovery, not only in the United States but in Japan, said that principles of economic recovery say workers will embrace change if they have security. People don't talk themselves out of work. And that also, if we're going to invest in technology, there are frontline costs that may cost additional dollars in the current biennium to do the technological things that Representative Downey's talking about. So they're not only cuts, but there are costs. We're confused if this is a reform bill or a cut bill. It looks to us like it's a cut bill. On the pension issues, there is a study coming out, and I do want to make a few things clear on pensions, Madam Chair. That on average, an AFSCME retiree makes $13,000 a year. $13,000 a year. Combined with Social Security, it's the difference between dignity and poverty. I also want to point out, Madam Chair, that 90% of retired workers stay in Minnesota. Their pensions fuel the local economy and keep seniors self-sufficient. The Minnesota pension system pays out more than $2.5 billion, adding $3.3 billion to the state economy, and creates 22,500 jobs in this state. And finally, state and local taxes collected on our pensions exceed public employer pension contributions by $80 million a year. Madam Chair and members of the committee, be careful what you ask for. You could make the recession a lot worse, or you can make it a lot better. On behalf of AFSCME members in state service, we want to deliver the most efficient services possible. We want to do so collaboratively and collectively. But
Mr. Side, could you please begin to wrap up?
Holding a Damocles sword over our head or threatening us with layoffs isn't the way to get better efficient services. It is the way to add to the recession in our economy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Side. I think we'll... Question? We have some amendments before us. Does anybody want to volunteer the First Amendment? Representative Nelson, or
I've got House File 8, or FA, or yeah, Amendment 8, A8.
Could you move that amendment, Representative Nelson?
I'd like to move H0004A8 amendment.
Okay, Representative Nelson moves the H0004A8 amendment. I'll wait till everybody gets the amendment, but you can start talking about it.
And what this does is the amendment says is the study must be included that is in the bill, the actuarial cost of switching from an employee from a defined contribution to a defined benefit, from a defined benefit to a defined contribution pension. As we heard from the Pension Commission yesterday, part of the problem with the MRF pension that we've had to put money in the past few years and merge into the para pension has to do with the cost that it's a closed pension. When you close the pension, there's cost to that, and those costs grow exponentially as you go forward because you've got less people contributing to it and more people taking out of it. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to do that, we want to know what the costs are, because otherwise we're not going to realize any savings out of this bill if we move forward. So that's my amendment.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Downey, do you have a comment on this amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Nelson. Actually, I would say that I agree in totality with the spirit of the amendment. I'm not sure that it belongs in this bill. I think the analysis and this study is already being performed at the request of the legislature last year. We're currently conducting a study on the costs and issues between defined benefit and defined contribution in another study group, and its report is due in June, I believe. So I'm not sure that we need to launch another one. And I would make a really important distinction here. This was with regard to the Minsky testimony as well. Just sidebar, I agree with the comment of the Minsky testifier, and we explicitly excluded Minsky from this bill, in part because I think they are doing a good job managing their costs. And also, maybe more importantly, it says that the governor may use any or all of the following. So there's no mandate to move to defined benefit. If that's a good tool, and if this study, you know, that's being concluded in June recommends it, and it's viable and the legislature enacts it through the normal pension process, I'd say that's fine. So I guess with that as an explanation, I'd urge a no vote on this amendment. I just think it's redundant with what we're already doing.
Okay, any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of the H004A8 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Amendment is not adopted. We have another amendment. Looks like the H004A7, Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, before I move to the A8 amendment, the A7 amendment, I'd like to follow up on this theme of the effect on the pension system that this bill may have. And I talked this over with Mr. Shepard, and he reminded me that the Pension Commission never actually has jurisdiction over bills. All the Pension Commission does is make recommendations for bills, which are then carried in these committees. But I think this bill is too important. The issues raised by this bill are too important to send it forward without having the Pension Commission weighing in. And so my motion is to lay this bill on the table until such time as the Pension Commission can make a recommendation on the provisions related to pensions.
Okay. Representative Downey, I would be opposed to that, but maybe you have a different thought.
Madam Chair, I think I'll defer to the committee chairs in deciding jurisdiction. At this point, I would concur with your sentiment that would go right to state government finance.
Okay, any other discussion? I think we'll have you restate your motion since it's not labeled, and then we will take a vote.
Madam Chair, my motion is to lay this bill on the table until such time as the Pension Commission can make a recommendation on the provisions related to pensions.
All those in favor of the Winkler motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Amendment does not prevail.
And then, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A7 amendment.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, the point here, and I'm certain Representative Downey will say that we shouldn't be excluding categories of people, but I think we have to understand that state employees are not just an amorphous group of people who are out living off the taxpayer. State employees are people who provide vital and essential public services that we all need. And as a result, I've selected a number of them. We've discussed snowplow drivers. We've discussed state troopers. But there are a number of others, corrections officials, criminal investigators, the tax compliance auditors that we routinely hire in order to increase the amount of revenue that we're collecting. We've had significant problem with fiscal mismanagement in this state, and I don't think we should be reducing those people. We have concerns about data security. I don't think we should be laying off information security staff without having a real understanding of what the impacts are going to be. So my motion, Madam Chair, is A7, is to exclude this list of people. And I would ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. We'll take a roll call. First, Representative Winkler, my understanding is that because of the A1 author's amendment that had passed earlier, we need to change on line 1.2. Line 13 should be changed to line 16.
Madam Chair, I incorporate that into my motion.
Okay. Representative Winkler incorporates the motion. We have before us H004A7. Representative Downey, would you like to comment on this amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler. I appreciate the spirit of this as well, and did consider myself whether to include something like this. I know we talked, I know in some of my comments earlier about opportunities in a lot of these areas, which are not in any way an attack on these professions or a knock on the work they're doing, but just representing the fact that there are opportunities all over state and local government for improvement and efficiency and privatization. And I just wouldn't want to take any of these off the table and create some sacred cows. And I trusted Governor Pawlenty when I offered this last year to do the right thing by the people of Minnesota and the employees of the state, and I am going to grant that same trust and confidence in Governor Dayton as well. I think this is more for Governor Dayton than for the legislature.
Okay, is there further discussion on the amendment? If not, clerk will take the roll.
Representative Pepin?
No.
Representative Murray?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
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 Representative Beard?
Nay.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
Nay.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative McFarland?
No.
Representative Driscoll?
No.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Yes.
Okay. There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Are there additional amendments? Back to the bill. Do you have closing comments, Representative Downey?
Madam Chair, I think we've very fully debated the issue in the bill, and I appreciate it a lot and appreciate your consideration.
Before I renew my motion,
Representative Beard.
Thank you. I appreciate the good conversation around this bill as it starts its way through what first of, I'm sure, many stops. One of the concerns I had was the pension portion that Representative Winkler referred to. And I know they do not have a regularly scheduled meeting time. And to this point, I don't even know if the the Speaker and Minority Leader have reconstituted the Pension Commission for this new biennium yet. However, I'm sure that if there are commission things, I would implore my friends on the Pension Commission, not that I'm volunteering for that commission, by the way, that they would actually ask for and comment on the bill if that's necessary. There was, however, Senate File 16 or 14, Representative Carlson's bill from last year. And my suggestion would be, as I renew my motion to move it to State Gov Finance, that maybe you explore the route that that bill took through the legislature before it was passed and signed into law, and see maybe there's something to be suggested there on who weighed in on it and how the Pension Commission added their 2 cents and so on and so forth. With that, Madam Chair, I'll renew the motion that I made originally.
Thank you. And I'm going to take one more question. Representative McFarland has been waiting patiently for probably an hour.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a comment. It was 1 week ago today that we were at the One Minnesota Conference at the Humphrey Institute, and we were there bipartisanly, bicameral, to talk about innovation, to talk about reform and things that we're doing. We heard about the demographic challenges that we're going to have. We heard from the national business officers in comparison to others. But I think one of the things that has been done bipartisanly was the Collaborative Governance Council last year, and also the Minnesota Commission on Service Innovation, which Representative Downey and Senator Bonhoeff had. And I think that, and then also it ended with Larry Keeley talking about innovation and how we need to work outside of our silos. And I hope that we'll keep that in mind as this bill progresses, because I think that's an important lesson, that we need to work together to find the solutions that we can all work with in the future.
Thank you. I believe Representative Beard, you'd already made your motion to that House File 4 is recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to State Government Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 4 will be re-referred, will pass this amendment and be re-referred to State Government Finance. Thank you, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'll adjourn the meeting, and I'll see you all tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.